Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Fabulous Fab is fabulous no more. The government gets its man, or a man, 5 years after the financial crisis. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday, the first day of August. Good to have you with us. One of the people involved in the mortgage crisis, former Goldman Sachs Vice President Fabrice Tour, you may remember him as Fabulous Fab, has been found liable for fraud by the SEC. Our own Stacey Vanek Smith has been covering the case, and she joins us. Thanks, Stacey.
Hi, Lizzie.
So, remind us of the details of this case. What was he charged with?
Yes. Well, Fabrice Tour, or Fabulous Fab, as he's sometimes called, he was a trader at Goldman Sachs. And back in 2007, around the height of the housing bubble, Tour apparently put together a package of subprime mortgage securities. And he apparently knew that those investments were going to fail. He had people invest in them, and they did fail. And then in 2010, the Securities and Exchange Commission sued Tour for securities fraud.
Stacey, this is the government's first win against an individual from the financial crisis. How significant is it?
Well, that's true, Lizzie, and I think it is significant. Back in 2009, the commission went after a couple of fund managers at Bear Stearns, and it lost. And since then, the SEC's brought dozens of cases against companies, but most of them have been settled without admissions of wrongdoing. And this is the first guilty verdict that the SEC has gotten. SEC lawyers have been calling Tour the face of Wall Street greed, and I think kind of painting him as symbolic of the carelessness and arrogance that contributed to the financial crisis.
On the other hand, he's one guy. He wasn't that senior. We're not talking about Lloyd Blankfein, the CEO of Goldman Sachs here. So there were lots of other people making bad decisions. What about them?
Yes, Lizzie, that's really true. He was just a trader at Goldman Sachs. The SEC went after Goldman Sachs, the company. It settled with the SEC for $550 million, but it didn't admit to any wrongdoing. Tour wanted to clear his name, but you're totally right. The SEC didn't go after CEO Lloyd Blankfein or any of the other higher-ups. I asked Joe Grunfest about that. He's a professor of law and business at Stanford. He's also a former commissioner of the SEC. And I asked him why regulators singled out a low-ranking guy and didn't go after the executives.
One of the reasons, I think, very simply, is he generated the juiciest email as the prosecutors attempting to optimize the chance that they will actually win the case as opposed to getting to the essential and ultimate truth of the case.
In other words, the SEC fights the fights it thinks it can win to some extent. And the evidence they had against Tour himself was very strong.
All right, Stacey, obviously the SEC says, yay, we got a big case here. This is a win for us. How significant is it really for them?
Well, you know, I think it is and it isn't. A lot of people had criticized the SEC for being a little bit toothless in the wake of the financial crisis. But as we spoke about earlier, I mean, Fabrice Tour is a kind of a low-level trader. He's not one of the big guys. And we're getting to the point where these cases aren't going to be able to be brought anymore. The SEC is hitting up against its 5-year statute of limitations pertaining to the financial crisis.
Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith. Stacey, thank you so much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
President Obama has spent much of the past week talking about manufacturing and the jobs that come with it, ones he says pay a decent wage. Well, we got word today that manufacturing activity grew last month, its highest level in 2 years. That's according to the Institute for Supply Management. So what kind of jobs come with that growth? Sally Herships has more.
You would think this would be a happy story about tons of new jobs being created. According to ISM, manufacturing is on a roll. We are making more
autos, airliners, and houses.
Robert Johnson is the director of economic analysis at Morningstar. He says we might like to think more jobs are being created because factories are producing more car parts, cockpit mechanisms, and furniture, but it's just not that simple.
I mean, I can't tell you how many times I sit down and talk with our analysts and they say, I can't believe I just went out of this factory and there were like 10 guys sitting around computers.
Computers. Hang on to that picture. Ricardo Ernst teaches global supply chain management at Georgetown's McDonough School of Business.
The nature of manufacturing is changing significantly.
Ernst says sectors where manufacturing is perking up, like the automotive industry, are becoming increasingly automated, which means fewer jobs for humans. And we still have a lot of lost manufacturing jobs to make up for. Dean Baker is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research.
We lost 2 million manufacturing jobs in the downturn. So we have a really big hole, and we're really just at the beginning of making any of that up.
And these days, those replacement jobs require higher skills. Morningstar's Robert Johnson says a job in manufacturing, if you get one, is a good job. The average wage is around $24 an hour, a lot higher than many other options. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
The Affordable Care Act, aka Obamacare, stands to overhaul a big chunk of the U.S. economy. In just 2 months, people across the country can sign up for insurance on the new health exchanges. So, starting today, we'll follow how this law will work in one place, Camden, New Jersey. 77,000 people live there, across the water from Philadelphia. Camden's residents are mostly poor, many are sick and uninsured, and medical care can be hard to get. In big hospitals and small clinics, the city faces just about every healthcare challenge imaginable, including runaway costs. But what works in Camden could become a model for the rest of the country. From the health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein starts our series with this look at the city.
There was a time when Camden really was on the map. The Camden County Historical Society's Sandy Levin says you could actually hear the city's promise along the waterfront. The New York Shipbuilding Corporation, at its peak during World War II, was the most productive shipyard in the world.
The thud of the metal being laid into place, the rivets being driven in.
Campbell's Soup was here too. Then there was the RCA Victor Empire, 31 factories manufacturing phonographs like the Victrola and records. The city's waterfront drove the economy here. At its height, Camden was an economic powerhouse, employing 80,000 industrial workers in a city of 120,000.
I just think of what a proud history the city of Camden had.
Standing in front of one of the few remaining RCA buildings, you can't hear that Camden anymore.
Camden City broke its all-time yearly murder total Friday.
Breaking news, police in Camden on the scene of a terrible crime.
Nearly 90% of Camden schools are in the bottom 5%.
Now Camden, New Jersey is laying off their entire police force.
Tonight we begin with the poorest city in the nation and the most dangerous city all in the same place. It's Camden, New Jersey.
That's right, the criminal background map. That's the black eye on Camden.
That's Brenda Lopez. She's 35. She's spent her whole life here.
Back in the day, my parents used to leave their windows and doors open in Camden, and you would feel safe to just lay your head down for a couple-minute nap. Now you can't do that.
Today, Lopez says there's a lot of desperation. People have stolen aluminum bleachers from city parks, a bulldozer from a construction site.
In order for me to go to Disney this year, I have to leave my parents babysitting my house, because if not, I'll come back to nothing. Bare walls, holes in your walls, graffiti, your pipes, your basement is flooded now because they're after your copper piping. This is the real life of Camden.
A life where there isn't enough work, drugs are sold in the open, schools are failing, and the last grocery store in a city of nearly 80,000 is pulling up stakes. That life takes a toll that Lopez sees every day when she shows up for work at one of Cooper University Hospital's outpatient clinics, a waiting room of people too worn down to take care of themselves. Lopez says she hears stories like this all the time.
I should have came for my weekly blood work, but I haven't been here in 3 months because I forgot. You get these patients that have cancer. They didn't even know.
Like lots of things in the city, healthcare doesn't work like it should.
We have a lot of people who will come to the emergency department. There is no medical complaint. There is no medical emergency. We just frankly ask, is it really chest pain or is that you need a turkey sandwich?
Emergency room doctor Maya Dom says she recently treated a guy who got kicked out of his girlfriend's apartment and was walking around the city in 9 pairs of socks.
At the end of the day, the intervention he needed were a pair of shoes.
The most common emergency in a Camden ER? Colds and earaches. Translation, not enough primary care. Things may be desperate in Camden, but Dr. Jeff Brenner, the medical director of Cooper's Urban Health Institute and regarded as a health reform pioneer, says it's true across the country.
Lots of people in America have a hard time getting access to care. Lots of middle-class people call for appointments and can't get in to be seen.
Brenner says it's expensive enough to treat someone in the ER who just needs a Tylenol. But the real cost of poor primary care comes from healthcare's failure to manage the chronically sick.
I could stick someone in a limo, drive them around the city, hire a personal doctor, bring their pills to them every day for less than what we're spending right now on hospitalization.
In Camden, just 8% of patients make up nearly 40% of the costs. The city's three hospitals have been awarded nearly $3 million in federal grants to help improve primary care for the sickest and most expensive patients. Brenner says the partnership among competing hospitals is just one sign that the Affordable Care Act is changing the business of healthcare.
I think what it's done is sent a really strong market signal that the system's going to change and that people have to change what they're doing.
A signal that the way hospitals and doctors get paid doesn't work. Now they make money by testing, cutting, zapping, and hospitalizing. And the more they do, the more they make. But under the ACA, doctors and hospitals will be rewarded for holding costs down and punished for patients who are readmitted over and over again. And most of those patients are the chronically ill. Cooper Healthcare's Senior Vice President of Operations and ER Doctor Anthony Mazzarelli says hospitals can't afford to keep this up.
Patients who are underpayers, right, the underinsured, taking care of those patients doesn't help us make money and potentially takes up space where other patients that would pay more would be.
But how do you keep these people out of the hospital? Mazzarelli says there's no clear path.
It's very easy to say, we'll get rid of unnecessary ED visits. Okay, but how do you do it? What are the tactics you actually use to do it? And those are the sort of experiments. There's no silver bullet. I would love to tell you, well, the answer is X.
So would every other hospital executive in America. There's a lot of money to be made figuring out how to manage this huge population of poor, sick people. The CDC says 3/4 of all healthcare dollars are spent on the chronically ill. But for all of its struggles, this is where Camden may actually be ahead of the curve. Dr. Jeff Brenner says for several years, the city's three hospitals have shared patient data that lets them target this population.
We know in real time when a patient lands in the hospital, and we go right up to the bedside, follow them out of the hospital, go with them to their primary care office, go with them to their specialty office.
Unlocking this healthcare puzzle could mean a lot in this city. Some of its sickest residents get better care, and some of the city's largest employers, the hospitals, get stronger, generating jobs and tax base for a place that needs both.
I am a total optimist. I want to be the most innovative, interesting healthcare system in the world. I want people to come to Camden and say, how did you do that?
A few weeks back, Brenner drove me around Camden, stopping at the waterfront, the factories and shipyard long gone. He pointed to one of the remaining buildings of the RCA Victor Kingdom. It's been converted into luxury lofts. It may also be where Camden's past meets its future. Brenner says medical students live there. In Camden, I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report, Dan profiles a small clinic that could play a big role in lowering costs and improving care in Camden. Coming up, are we seeing the end of the suburbs?
I mean, a lot of people who bought into the suburbs are realizing it's not really delivering on what it promised.
But first, let's do the numbers. Hello, August. The Dow Jones Industrial Average picked up 0.8% or 128 points to close at 15,628. That's a record high. The S&P 500 took home 1.25%, 21 points, to end at 1706, another record high. And the NASDAQ had a very good day, up 1.33%, or 49 points, to end at 3675. Overseas, London's FTSE rose nearly 1%, the French CAC 40 added 1.25%, and Germany's DAX advanced 1.5%. In Tokyo, the Nikkei ascended 2.5%. Bond prices fell, the yield on the 10-year T-note rose 2.70%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. Are unemployment lines getting shorter? The Labor Department releases its monthly jobs report for July. The Commerce Department issues personal income and spending data for June. And on August 2nd, 1922, inventor Alexander Graham Bell died at the age of 75. He held the first patent for the telephone. It's that device you text on. LOL. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary in for Kai Rizdahl. Major League Baseball is weighing whether to ban New York Yankees Alex Rodriguez from the game for life for using performance-enhancing drugs. So here's my real question. What kind of incentive would actually stop a player from doping? Joining us now to answer it is Toby Moskowitz, a professor at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so basically I need you to convince me not to do drugs. And let's set aside morals, being a role model, whatever. If I'm a Major League Baseball player and I've got a $100 million contract over 10 years and I get caught doping, they're going to knock me out for 50 games. That's like $3 million. In the overall scheme of things, that's nothing.
Well, I would agree. And also there's the benefit of why you think about taking those drugs in the first place, which is improving your performance, perhaps signing a lengthier contract, or more to the point, just staying in the league that much longer, which is far more lucrative than the $3 million you'd give up if you got caught. And that's a big if.
I don't mean to make light of $3 million, but we're talking about scale here and what the sort of tipping point is from a financial incentive point for players not to dope. What, do we have any sense of what that is?
You know, especially for the very top guys, I'm not even sure if financial incentive is the right way to think about it. I mean, at some level it would be. I suppose if you nullified the contract entirely, that would have an impact. I think what they're talking about currently with A-Rod in particular, a lifetime ban, I think that would scare a lot of players. I mean, these guys have made plenty of money, and as long as they manage it reasonably well, they're going to be able to live off that for a very long time, generationally, actually, so their kids will be fine, too. It's more about, you know, their place in history, and I think maybe that's where, at least at the top end, Major League Baseball can have some effect. But really, the drug problem is much more prevalent. We hear about the A-Rods, but it's really the minor leaguers and the players you've never heard of. If you're coming from a poor background where this is everything for you, you'll do anything you can to make it. And that incentive is not going away. It's really hard to create a punishment big enough on the other side. These guys are desperate at that point.
Separate from the players, the league is a business, too. I mean, they want to make money here.
Absolutely. And right now, I think the league is in a bit of limbo. You know, there's sort of two scenarios. One is a complete zero tolerance crackdown, make sure nobody's using drugs ever, and there's huge stiff penalties. There's the other extreme, which some people have advocated, which is just let anybody use whatever they want. Unfortunately, there's somewhere in between where it's illegal, it's not punished as much as it probably should be, and then you have some players that want to be clean, but they realize they're at a disadvantage playing against players that aren't clean. They're in a funny situation here, and I think they're struggling with what to do, how hard to come down on this.
Is A-Rod a game changer? I mean, we're talking about the highest paid athlete in sports. If he goes down, does that change things?
I think if you put a lifetime ban on somebody like an A-Rod, I think that sends a very strong signal throughout the league, in particular at the top end, which, let's face it, from a publicity point of view, that's probably what the league cares about most, is keeping the big-time players clean. And my guess is the fans would be fine with that, too. Now, are they going to do it? I would bet not, but, you know, let's see what happens.
Toby Moskowitz, professor at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It seems like every week the U.S. Postal Service comes up with yet another plan to revive the snail mail business and save itself. Today, it launched a discount program for marketers who want to send us little samples of things like detergent and toothpaste, 5% off. Seems those freebies have fallen out of favor lately, kind of like the post office. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports.
Jen Drexler is a VP at Insight Strategy Group.
I remember growing up and seeing boxes of cereal come with the newspaper.
and it's been a long time since I've seen that happen.
Sherry Orell is head of the Product Sampling Council at the Brand Activation Association.
I think product sampling overall is in a bit of a decline over the last probably 10 years.
Orell says it's not because sending samples isn't effective. It is, especially for new products. But success is hard to measure. If you put out a bottle of shampoo at the gym, how do you know if that makes people buy it later?
That's the golden question.
And there are a few tricks to product sampling. You have to get it to people at just the right time and place.
If your target consumer is Vanessa, and you hand Vanessa a sample of shampoo as she's coming off the subway, it's going into her bag, and there are multiple hurdles associated with getting that out of her bag and into the shower.
Marketers also need to know that she's the one who's using it.
Make it accountable. It cannot be just, here's your free sample.
Doug Geyer is president of product sampling company BrandShare. He says to make samples worthwhile, marketers need to be able to track consumer behavior using coupons or online surveys that might come with free samples.
It's the most expensive marketing tactic, yet most effective.
Orland says big companies are becoming more aware of the lost art of product sampling. So between that and the Postal Service discount, maybe we can all expect more freebies at the front door. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Paint yourself a mental picture of a suburb, that symbol of the American dream. White picket fences, friendly neighbors, 2.5 kids.
It's quiet, it's clean, you know, it's not like the city.
It was a nice place to live. Yeah.
And it's a great place for my kids to grow up.
That's a few residents of Levittown, Long Island, the first mass-produced suburb in the U.S. Despite the good things they had to say, there's also this.
It's not a nice place anymore. You know, it's overburdened, overbuilt, over, you know, it's just a lousy place to live.
I see a lot of young people moving out because they can't afford to live here.
You know, when I find a good, stable job, I plan on trying to move out to the boroughs.
In fact, Americans are leaving the suburbs. For the first time in a century, cities are growing faster than burbs. That's something Lee Gallagher explores in her new book, The End of the Suburbs, Where the American Dream is Moving. She's an assistant managing editor at Fortune and a regular here with us. Lee, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
The title of your book is The End of the Suburbs. Really? The end? That's it? They're gone? Come on.
Well, it's the end of the suburbs as we know them. This country has been built on this suburban model that is failing in many ways. And people want somewhere that is going to give them a happier, healthier life. I mean, I realize this is provocative, but Toll Brothers, the builder of large, huge luxury suburban homes, is building 30 buildings in New York City. So something is happening and people want something different.
Before I read your book, I think like many people had this picture of the suburbs as sort of a free market, American independence, patch of your own grass. But that's not how they grew up.
No, not at all. I mean, people forget, but after World War II, we actually had a tremendous housing shortage, which is like almost laughable now. You can't even imagine what that must be like given our current housing situation. But we had all these GIs coming back from the war, and we had nowhere to put them. I mean, people were living in their living rooms of their parents. People were shacked up in Quonset huts. I mean, there was nowhere to go. And so the government sort of said, you know, we're going to give loans for returning veterans. And the federal highway bill paved the way for massive amounts of highway.
And everybody's favorite tax deduction came along.
Oh, of course. Oh, the mortgage interest tax deduction has a huge influence in driving us to move to the suburbs because it encourages buying houses over apartments. It really does. And it encourages you to buy more house than you can afford, which, of course, once the housing boom came along, we didn't need any more help doing that. But it gave a huge assist to the growth of suburbia.
You tell some stories about the demographic shifts that are driving the changes in the way we live. And one that blew me away is that there are actually more kind of retiring baby boomers out in the burbs than there are stereotypical young families.
Yeah, this is a huge kind of demographic bombshell that's sort of happening. Because of the housing crisis, a lot of senior citizens or baby boomers, people who would be ready to retire, you know, they couldn't beat the normal path to the Sun Belt. My father grew up in a neighborhood called Drexel Hill, Pennsylvania. And when he grew up, in the 1950s, there were 41 kids on his block. And I actually hired a private investigator to go and count how many kids there are now, and there's less than 15.
Wow.
And you see, actually, suburbs are having to deal with this, because when you have more older people in the suburbs, you know, these are the taxpayers. They're not going to have the same priorities as young families who want to make the schools better.
Where are things moving now? What happens?
It's not just about moving back to the city. It's not like everyone wants to live in a New York City skyscraper. That's absolutely not the case. But people want to be in communities that are livelier, where they can get to know their neighbors more. And so there's this massive demand for more sort of urban suburbs, but there's not enough of them to meet the demand that we're going to face.
You tell a story in this book that made me laugh out loud about how at a certain point you stopped telling people that you were writing a book about the death of the suburbs because you would get trapped in these endless conversations.
It's true. It's true. You know, the interesting thing I found about this topic, so many people grew up in the suburbs. It's where most people in this country live. It strikes a chord with everyone. And people see that there's something happening. People see that they want a different kind of maybe lifestyle than they grew up in or than they bought into. I mean, a lot of people who bought into the suburbs are realizing it's not really delivering on what it promised.
Lee Gallagher is the author of The End of the Suburbs, Where the American Dream is Moving. Lee, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, a bit of an Eastern European geography lesson. Gay bars in the U.S. and Europe have ditched Russian vodka in the last week to protest anti-LGBT laws in that country and the threat to arrest gay athletes and supporters at the Sochi Winter Olympics next year. But gay campaigners in Latvia say, hold up a second, don't boycott Stolichnaya vodka over Russian gay rights abuses, explaining that it's made in their country, Latvia, not Russia. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Ethan Lindsay, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. Hope you all join us again tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.